Hello, and welcome to GoGo Radio, found exclusively on gogo.com. My name is Mike Simpson, and on today's show, we are going to discuss Java 6's core packages. Be sure to check out my GoGo profile, and be sure to send in any questions or comments using the box below. All right, let's get started. Programs are organized in Java as sets of packages. Each package has its own set of names for types, and that set of names for types helps to prevent name conflicts. A top-level type is accessible outside of the package that declares it only if that particular type is declared as public. Now, the naming structure for packages is hierarchical. The members of a package are classes and interfaces, which are declared in the appropriate compilation units of a package. And again, the compilation units for a package are simply the software files that we use to compile, and sub-packages. And sub-packages can have compilation units and sub-sub-packages of their own. A package can be stored in a file system, or a package can be stored in a database. Packages that are stored in a file system may have some constraints on their organization, or on the organization of their associated compilation units, and those structures are to allow a simple implementation to be able to find classes easily. A package, as mentioned earlier, consists of a number of compilation units. A compilation unit will automatically have access to all of the types that are declared in its package. And the compilation unit will automatically import all of the public types that are defined in the java.lang package. A compilation unit consists of an optional package declaration, an optional import declaration, and optional top-level type declarations of class types and of interface types. Now, a package can be unnamed or can have a simple name for small programs and for casual development. And if you do not explicitly put the application that you develop into a particular package, then all of your source code goes into the same sort of package. It's called a default package. But if code is going to be widely distributed, then unique package names should be chosen. Choosing unique package names prevents conflicts that would otherwise occur if two development groups happen to pick the same package names and those packages were later to be used in a single program. And again, choosing unique package names makes sure that the variables and the methods that are defined within those separate package names, you don't get naming conflicts. Java provides 11 core packages, which together comprise most of the functionality that developers expect. We'll look at each of these packages in turn. The java.lang package provides classes that are fundamental to the design of the Java programming language. Now, the most important classes in java.lang are object, which is the root of the class hierarchy, and class, instances of which represent classes at runtime. Object is with a capital O and class is with a capital C. Now, frequently, it's necessary to represent a value of a primitive type as if it were an actual object. The wrapper classes Boolean with a capital B, character with a capital C, integer with a capital I, long with a capital L, float with a capital F, and double with a capital D serve this purpose of wrapping the primitive types in appropriate objects. An object of type double, for example, capital D double, contains a field whose type is lowercase d double, representing that value in such a way that a reference to it can be stored in a variable of reference type. These classes also provide a number of methods for converting among primitive values, as well as supporting standard methods like equals and hash code. The void class, capital V, is a non-instantiable class, but that's going to hold a reference to a class object that represents the primitive type void. And remember that in Java, the primitive type void basically means no value, and we use void when we have a method that's not going to return a value, what we call a procedure in other language. The java.util package contains the collections framework, it contains legacy collection classes, it contains the event model, it contains date and time facilities, it contains internationalization, and it contains some miscellaneous utility classes, such as a string tokenizer, a random number generator, and a bit array. The collections framework includes the iterator interface, which is used to iterate over the elements of a collection, the map interface to map keys to values, the set interface, which ensures that you have no duplicate elements, and the list interface, which is an ordered collection or sequence. There are also classes that implement each of these interfaces. So you basically can have a map class set class, list class, things like that. The map, set, and list interfaces may be parameterized at instantiation, which basically means that if you want to have a list of integers, you can say list angle bracket integer angle bracket. The date class represents a specific instant in time, and when we're talking about dates, the Java dates can be millisecond level of precision. So we can show hours, minutes, seconds, and millionths of a second. The calendar class is an abstract class, and this class provides methods for converting between a specific instant in time and appropriate calendar fields like the year, the month, the day of the month, the hour, and so on. The math class, capital M math, provides commonly used mathematical functions like sine, sine, cosine, and square root. The string class and the string buffer class provide commonly used operations on character strings. The class loader, process, runtime, security manager, and system classes collectively provide system operations that manage the dynamic loading of classes, the creation of appropriate external processes, enforcement of security processes, and hosting environmental inquiries, such as trying to figure out the time of day. The class throwable encompasses objects that may be thrown by the throw statement. Now that sounds tautological, but subclasses of throwable represent errors and exceptions. So when something unusual is generated in our application, we'll either create an exception object or an error object. Exception objects differ from error objects in that we expect our code to handle exception objects without completely blowing up our application, whereas if an error object is generated, and that's generated by the Java runtime, and will usually cause the application to terminate. The throwable class is the parent of both error and exception. Now let's talk about the Java input and output package, the java.io package. This package provides system input and output through data streams, through serialization, and through the file system. The data input and data output interfaces allow you to convert data from any of the Java primitive types to a series of bytes, and then it lets you transfer those bytes to or from a binary stream. The serializable interface is a marker interface, and that marker interface indicates that the contents of the object will be written to disk or read from disk. Classes that build upon this functionality for file input and output include PrintStream and PrintWriter as classes, the buffered input stream and buffered output stream classes, and the filter input stream and filter output stream classes. The file class, which is also a part of this package, provides an abstract representation of a file or directory to a Java application. The java.math package provides classes for performing arbitrary precision integer arithmetic in a class called BigInteger, and arbitrary precision decimal arithmetic in a class called BigDecimal. Now, since we already have classes called integer and decimal, you might say, why do we need BigInteger and BigDecimal? Well, BigInteger is analogous to Java's primitive integer types, but it provides arbitrary precision, which means that operations on big integers will not overflow or lose precision. If you try to add two regular integers, you can have arithmetic overflow if they're large enough, but you won't get that with big integers. In addition to doing standard arithmetic stuff, BigInteger allows you to do primality testing, prime generation, bit manipulation, greatest common denominator calculation, and a few other miscellaneous operations. BigDecimal provides arbitrary precision signed decimal numbers suitable for currency calculations and the like. So if you need to calculate currencies, you can do that with a BigDecimal. BigDecimal gives the user complete control over rounding behavior. So you can decide how you're going to round up, round down, and things like that, and you can handle that with a BigDecimal if need be. Next, we'll take a look at the java.net package. The java.net package provides classes for implementing networking applications. You can divide the java.net package into two sections. There is a low-level API which deals with addresses, like IP addresses, sockets, basic bidirectional data communication mechanisms, and interfaces, which handle network interfaces. And those classes handle the low-level API. The high-level API deals with universal resource identifiers, or URIs, universal resource locators, or URLs, and connection objects, which represent connections to the resources that are pointed to by URLs. Now, how should we use the entries in the java.net package? Well, the proper way to use them is to use the URI class, the Universal Resource Identifier, to identify resources, and then convert that URI into a URL when it's time to access the resource. There is a toURL method that'll let you do that. From that URL, you can either get the URL connection for find control or go directly to the input stream for that URL. Now, one of the interesting things is that when we do file input, we use a input stream to read and write data from files. But we also use the same input stream technology to read and write data over networks. So practicing file I/O also teaches you how to do network I/O. The next package we'll take a look at is the java.security package. And the java.security package provides classes and interfaces for the security framework. This package includes classes that implement easily configurable and fine-grained access control security architecture. This package also supports the generation and storage of cryptographic public key pairs, as well as a number of exportable cryptographic operations, including those operations for message digest and for signature generation. This package also includes classes that support signed objects, guarded objects, and secure random number generation. Now, there are a lot of classes that are provided in this package that are based for a particular provider, particularly the cryptographic and secure random number generator classes. Now, this class itself defines a particular programming interface to which applications may write. Now, you may say, well, what good is that going to do us? Well, what that good is that the implementation for that particular class can then be provided by an independent third-party vendor and plugged in seamlessly as needed, which means that a vendor can provide you with an appropriate cryptographic key, and if you don't like that vendor's version, you can supply it with another vendor's version. Therefore, application developers may take advantage of any number of provider-based implementations for cryptographic operations and other security stuff without having to add code or rewrite code, in which you can just plug in another vendor's implementation. The next package we'll take a look at is the java.sql package. The java.sql package provides the application programming interface that's used to access and process data stored in a data source, usually a relational database, using the Java programming language. This application programming interface includes an appropriate framework, and through this framework, different drivers may be installed dynamically to access different data sources. The Java Database Connectivity, or JDBC API, is mainly geared to passing SQL statements to a database. But you can actually read and write data using JDBC from any data source that has a tabular format. So although we don't necessarily recommend that you use JDBC to go against, say, a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, you can. This reader-writer facility, which is available through the javax.sql.rowset group of interfaces, may be customized to use and update data from a spreadsheet, from a flat file, or from any other tabular data source. Now we're going to take a look at the java.awt, or Abstract Windowing Toolkit, package. The java.awt package contains all of the classes that are used for creating user interfaces, as well as for painting graphics and images. A user interface object such as a button or a scroll bar is called a component in AWT terminology. So the component class in the java.awt is the root of all AWT components. Some components fire events when a user interacts with them. The AWT event class and its subclasses are used to represent the events that AWT components can fire. A container is a component that can contain other components and can contain other containers. A container can also have a layout manager, and that layout manager controls the visual placement of components in the container. The AWT package contains several layout manager classes and an interface for building your own layout manager if the current layout managers don't meet your needs. The javax.swing package provides a set of lightweight, meaning all Java language, components that, to the maximum degree possible, work the same on all platforms. These are components that provide buttons, list boxes, checkboxes, menus, scroll buttons, and things like that. Swing components and related classes must be accessed on the event dispatching thread. So later on, when we deal with threads, realize that swing components are wonderful, but swing components are not generally thread safe. The javax.applet package provides the classes necessary to create an applet And it also provides the classes that an applet will use to communicate with the outside applet context. Remember that an applet will need to communicate with its outside context, usually a browser, to get resources for file input management and things like that. The applet framework involves two entities, the actual applet, the embeddable window, and then the applet context, which is an application that's responsible for loading and running applets, usually like a browser. There's also a new package called the java.nio, new input and output package, and that's mentioned now, even though it's going to become more prevalent in Java 7, because the beginnings of the package are available now in Java 6. The java.nio package defines buffers, containers for data, and provides an overview of the other NIO packages. The central and main abstractions for the NIO set are buffers, containers for data, char sets, which translate between individual bytes and Unicode characters, channels of various types, and channels represent connections to entities that are capable of performing I/O operations, and selectors and selection keys. And the selectors and selection keys allow you to set up a multiplexed and non-blocking I/O facility. Now, these buffers that we talked about are containers for a fixed amount of data of a specific type. So you can have buffers for 512 bytes or buffers for 2K bytes or what have you. In addition to content, the buffer has a position, and that position is the index of the next element to be read or written. And a buffer also has a limit, which is the index of the first element that should not be read or written. The base buffer class defines these properties. It also defines methods for clearing the buffer, flipping the buffer, rewinding the buffer, marking the current position in the buffer, and resetting the position in the buffer to the previous mark. Now, there are buffer classes for each of the non-Boolean primitive types. So there's buffer classes for bytes, chars, integers, floats, doubles, things like that. Each of these classes defines a set of get and put methods for moving data in and out of a buffer. It defines methods for compacting, duplicating, and slicing a buffer. And it defines some static methods for allocating a new buffer and wrapping an existing array into a buffer. So you can basically turn an array into a buffer by wrapping it appropriately. Byte buffers are distinguished in that they can be used as the sources and targets of I/O operations. Byte buffers also support several features that are not found in the other buffer classes. For instance, a byte buffer can be allocated as a direct buffer. And if it's allocated as a direct buffer, the Java virtual machine will make its best efforts to perform native I/O operations directly upon it. So it'll try not to have to go to the operating system to do the I/O. The Java virtual machine will try to do direct I/O to the buffer. A byte buffer can also be created by mapping a region of a file directly into memory. So you could have memory mapped files there, in which case a few additional file related operations that are defined in a particular class called the mapped byte buffer class are available. So that's how you do memory mapped files. Finally, a byte buffer class also provides access to a content as a heterogeneous or homogeneous sequence of binary data. And that can be either in big endian byte order or little endian byte order. Now, sometimes it's important to know whether it's big endian or little endian if you're actually having to read and process data at the individual byte level. I hope that you've enjoyed today's presentation. I look forward to your comments and to your questions. You may email your input to me by using the question box found on this page. I will be answering your questions and I'll be replying to your comments in upcoming presentations. If you're interested in viewing my other shows, just search the GoGo Radio Archive for my name, Mike Simpson. If there's a show that you would like for me to do, please send me an email and let me know. Thank you for your time today. And remember to tune into GoGo Radio, found exclusively on gogo.com.